Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Supply, demand. That's the way a market's supposed to work. We all know sometimes things take some tinkering. But today, some big utilities tried to rig a market that's not even running yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stenton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 17th of October. Great to have you with us once again. The market in question is for greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide specifically. Tomorrow, the latest version of what's called a cap-and-trade plan is set to be introduced in the Senate, a cap on the amount of CO2 that companies can spew out, a trade system to create a market for and put a price on those quotas. Big utility companies have been lobbying furiously for a version they can live with. And this afternoon, they petitioned the Senate for special relief. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Over the past year or so, a growing number of energy companies has endorsed the idea of cap and trade, and most would prefer passing legislation this year before the possibility of an even tougher bill if a Democrat is elected president. Utilities are now calling for a so-called safety valve provision that would allow the government to put a ceiling on the price of those emissions credits once they hit a certain level. Tom Williams at Duke Energy.
By putting an upper end limit on how much those allowances could ultimately sell for, that really prevents price spikes in electricity, and particularly those regions of the country that are very dependent on coal.
Utilities argue a safety valve would make prices more predictable so companies could better plan long-term investments. But environmental groups oppose a safety valve. Let the free market work, they say. If carbon prices go up, that will spur new clean energy technology. Frank O'Donnell, executive director of Clean Air Watch, says the point is emissions cuts, not price controls.
If you have a so-called safety valve, essentially it would neuter the legislation. It would be gutting any attempt to have an effective global warming plan.
The bill scheduled to be introduced tomorrow offers a compromise of sorts. Under that legislation, a board of experts could tinker with the system if it determined carbon prices significantly threatened the economy. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
A new study out today offers some compelling evidence the labor market has truly gone global. Roughly 150 million people have left their homes and taken jobs abroad. They send billions of dollars back home. And those foreign remittances, as they're called, are going to and coming from some unexpected places. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
What's the biggest anti-poverty program in the world? If you think it's run by the UN or World Bank, you're wrong. It's
poor people sending money to even poorer people, $100, $200, $300 at a time.
Donald Terry is the general manager of the Inter-American Development Bank. A report by Terry's bank and others found when you add it all up, the amount of money sent from migrant workers to family members back home topped $300 billion last year alone. To put that number in perspective, Terry says it's roughly three times the total global foreign aid budget. It's more money than the global aid budget and all direct foreign investment combined. And most of that money is not going to Latin America, and it's not coming from the U.S. Kevin Cleavers with the UN International Fund for Agricultural Development.
You think of this more as a Western Hemisphere phenomenon. This is now a global phenomenon. Mongolia gets remittances.
In fact, remittances account for more than 7% of that country's GDP. India received more than $24 billion from abroad last year, more than Mexico. And Russia received more than $13 billion this way.
I think this is a real paradigm shift, actually, because of the amounts that we're talking about and because it's in private hands.
Cleaver says this report was the first attempt to put a dollar figure on remittances globally, and he hopes it will help development economists change the way they think. At the very least, it illustrates that until now, the single largest source of aid to the developing world was operating almost entirely under the radar. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There are a couple of keys to building a successful brand. One of them is that the message be reasonably simple. And what could be more straightforward than the Better Business Bureau? You'd think clean business practices, right? For some, though, the BBB's become the place to go to complain about business. So today it launched a nationwide rebranding campaign to let people know it does some other things, too. Steve Tripoli has more now from the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk.
Complaints they've got. A record 1.2 million from consumers last year, says Steve Cox of the BBB's parent organization.
But we also found that only about 22% of adults had actually come to the Better Business Bureau for pre-purchase information at any point over the past 3 years. So we've got a record number of complaints, but then low usage on the pre-purchase side.
Which leads to that rebranding message.
Come to the BBB first before you make that purchasing decision.
They've got buying tips, info on scams, help finding trustworthy charities, and more. But Charlie Mattingly of the Bureau's Kentucky branch says a lot of other folks push that kind of information these days.
The Internet has changed the entire environment for BBB over the last several years. You've got everything from services like Angie's List to Consumer Reports, and they certainly drive home for us the need to be competitive and be agile in how we provide information.
So what's the Better Business Bureau's advantage? Steve Cox says it starts with 3 million individual reports on businesses, plus a giant good guy list.
We've got nearly 400,000 BBB accredited businesses all across the United States and Canada.
It's those members that fund the Bureau. But Charlie Mattingly says there's no conflict in that because the whole reason the Bureau exists is to monitor businesses. And he says consumers would notice kid glove treatment. BBB folks say all their offerings plus a spanking new website make them the best source of consumer information. And if the rebranded Bureau doesn't live up to those claims, that's simple. Just file a complaint with the... Wait a minute. Who would you complain to about them? I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Oil prices actually fell today. Investors were reassured by a tame inflation report. The housing market still stinks, but then again, you knew that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whether or not corporate America gets its way with the cap-and-trade bill Sarah Gardner was telling us about, lots of companies have already started to go green. They can't wait to tell you about it in their ads and their press releases. But commentator Robert Reich says, big whoop.
Consider British Petroleum, which a few years ago shortened its name to BP and has promoted itself with a $200 million ad campaign as the environmentally friendly oil company that will go beyond petroleum. So far, though, it's invested a tiny fraction of its oil profits in non-fossil-based fuels and caused the worst oil spill in the history of Alaska's fragile North Slope. Going green for public relations might help the bottom line, but it doesn't help the environment. Other companies are going green because they can save money that way. By using new, cleaner technologies, for example, Dow Chemical lowers its energy costs and reduces carbon emissions. By packaging its fresh produce in plastics made from corn sugar instead of petroleum, Walmart also cuts costs. Alcoa saves some $100 million a year by reducing its energy use. I think it's great that these and other companies are cutting their costs and increasing profits, but this is what companies are supposed to do. It's called good management. Some investment banks and private equity firms are going green because they anticipate regulations that will make green pay off and reduce returns to companies that don't go green. Goldman Sachs recently pushed TXU, a big Texas power company, to cut the number of coal-fired plants it was going to build because Goldman anticipates stricter regulations on coal-fired plants. Goldman isn't praiseworthy, it's just watching its money. Under supercapitalism, it's naive to think corporations can or will sacrifice profits and shareholder returns in order to fight global warming. Firms that go green to improve their public relations or cut their costs or anticipate regulations are being smart, not virtuous. So don't expect corporations to lead the charge on global warming. That's government's job. And next time you hear a company boast about how environmentally friendly it is, hold the applause.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. You can go online if you have some thoughts to share with us. Our website is marketplace.org. The Federal Reserve published its regional survey of the American economy today. The Beige Book landed with something of a thud. The Fed says growth has slowed almost everywhere. And the Treasury Department says foreign investors are pulling their money out of U.S. markets at a record pace. The Treasury International Capital Report, TIC it's called, came out late yesterday afternoon. We've got Alec Young from Standard & Poor's Equity Research on the line to explain it to us. Mr. Young, good to have you here.
Pleasure.
This tick report is as scary a name as that might be. The numbers in it, do they indicate foreign investors really with an aversion to American equities?
We don't think so. We think it was more of a one-month aberration. The August tick data reflected foreign investors selling dollar-denominated assets more than they have in the recent past. And we think that's a reflection of the fact that we had some real credit market turbulence in the month of August. And as investors had a lot of margin calls and whatnot on some illiquid assets, that forced them to sell their most liquid assets, which are generally U.S. Treasuries, in order to cover some of those margin calls. We think that was a phenomenon particularly evidenced in the hedge fund community. And that's really what drove the dollar selling in the month of August.
What about some of the continuing trends since August? I'm thinking specifically of dollar weakness here.
Sure. Sure. We think other factors are driving the dollar weakness, the biggest of which is interest rate differentials. You have the U.S. Central Bank reducing interest rates, reducing the amount of interest you earn on dollars, while most of the central banks around the world are actually raising interest rates and the interest you earn on their currencies. And so that makes the dollar less attractive, and we think that's driving the dollar weakness.
Let me take something you said and turn it on its head for a minute. You mentioned that investors consider dollar-denominated assets their most liquid thing, which is why they got sold in August. That really is a good thing that we're liquid, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it reflects how deep our capital markets are. There are so many players in here trading treasuries, trading U.S. stocks. The U.S. is still seen as the most transparent and dynamic economy in the world. And while there's certainly more competition today than there was 10 or 20 years ago, we don't see a lack of willingness by foreigners to hold our securities. If we continue to see that trend play out over the next few months, we may reevaluate. But at this point, we see it as more of a one-month aberration.
All right, but what if? You know, what if those numbers don't bounce back?
Well, that's something we'll have to take a look at if that turns out to be the case. But one thing that we think is likely to keep foreign central banks buying treasuries over the long term is that the U.S. is still a primary destination for a lot of their exports. And the way the U.S. funds a lot of its imports is through borrowed money by selling treasuries. So if the Chinese or the Japanese, if they stop buying treasuries, we stop buying their stuff. And if that happens, they're in just as much trouble as we are.
Alec Young is an international equity strategist at Standard & Poor's Equities Research. Mr. Young, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell a tenth of 1%, about 20 points today, to close at 13,892. The Nasdaq rose 1%, 28 points, to close at 2792. The S&P 500 pushed up a tenth of 1%, 2 points, ended the day at 1541. MGIC Investment plunged 15% on news the home loan insurer posted a heavy loss in the third quarter. United Technologies cooled off 3.5% today after it issued a gloomy forecast. The air conditioner maker blamed, yes, guess what, the struggling housing market. Yahoo had a lot to scream about, picking up nearly 8% today after the company's third quarter earnings beat estimates yesterday. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.56%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its index of leading economic indicators. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee discusses the effects of lead on children's health. And a House committee holds a hearing on successes as well as challenges that lie ahead as the Clean Water Act marks its 35th anniversary. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We mentioned something pretty rare on the program the other day, a profit warning from ExxonMobil. The world's largest publicly traded oil company said lower margins for its refineries will hit the bottom line. It'll still probably clear somewhere near $8 or $9 billion, though. Slide down the supply chain a bit, closer to your gas tank. It's a different story. Gas stations are seeing hard times, even the local Shell, and especially independents, moms and pops that sell non-branded gas. Kate Golden found one that's trying hard to hold on.
On a lazy Sunday in a ritzy part of Berkeley, California, the locals schmooze over wine and cheese at the Bridgeway.
Yeah, I have to say I've been to a lot of things, but I've never been to a gas station party before this.
This is no ordinary gas station. The Bridgeway closes by 6 p.m. on weekdays. You can't buy gas here at all on Sunday. The place fixes cars, but it doesn't sell chips or cigarettes. And forget swiping your credit card right on the pump. Steve Carvalho runs the place. His family's been in the service station business for 6 decades, 3 of them on this corner. Steve still remembers the day he and his dad sent his mom out for some tires.
She came back that day and said, "I bought another service station."
Back then, 30 years ago, you could make money owning a gas station. No longer, says Steve's dad, Harold.
The gas go up and up and up. I never thought it'd get this high.
Do the profits go up and up and up?
No, the profits didn't go. The profits went down, down, down.
We're talking profits of a penny or two a gallon here. The average station sells $5 million worth of fuel and corn chips each year, but makes just $45,000 net profit before taxes. That's partly because people will drive out of their way to save a few cents per gallon. Meanwhile, credit card companies are jacking up fees to gas stations, and big companies like Costco and Safeway can buy in bulk and deeply undercut the little guys. Which is why independents like Carvalho have the roughest time. They buy wholesale gas that isn't branded. Theoretically, it's a bit cheaper, but when supplies run tight, refiners make independents the lowest priority. And Carvalho's gas gets more expensive. That's been happening a lot lately.
You got our mobile lights.
So lots of gas stations bank on being convenience stores more than anything else. Gas is only marked up about 6%, but candy can be marked up 40% and sunglasses 100%.
All right, thank you. Have a good day, sir.
3/4 of the purchases are impulse buys. But Steve Carvalho is interested in helping people, not exploiting them.
I've loaned money to the kids when they forgot their lunch money. I've taken people home. I bailed a customer out of jail once.
When you pull up at the Bridgeway, a couple of greeters take your credit card while you pump your own gas. Regular Georgia Wright has been hooked for 30 years.
These two older guys who take your card and ask you about your family and the weather and the traffic and, you know, you come away and think, I've just had a human transaction.
That's Steve Carvalho's secret weapon, the one thing that most gas stations don't provide. In Berkeley, California, this is Kate Golden for Marketplace.
If you love hot sauce, Light My Fire's the place for you. It's a shop here in Los Angeles that sells nothing but more than 500 different varieties. One thing you won't find, though, perhaps the most famous hot sauce of all.
Tabasco? Actually, no. It's because it's a common sauce, and we prefer to carry things that people don't normally get.
Persia Tong runs the store. Her crack about Tabasco being a common sauce is exactly the problem facing the company and the McElhenney family that founded it. Jeffrey Rothfeder explains the dilemma in his new book, McElhenney's Gold. Well, that's a bit of a struggle that they're going through right now. I mean, they're kind of caught in the middle. On the one hand, they've got the radical fringe, which are the chili heads. And the chili heads are coming out with products that are really, really powerful, like one called Da Bomb, which is the hottest sauce you can imagine. You take one little taste and your mouth virtually explodes. And then on the low end, they've got commodity companies that are just pumping out this stuff, not with any quality or any care for the product, and they're charging about half the price of Tabasco sauce. So now they're facing a time when they're going to have to address these issues a little bit more.
Before we get to the business and to the company that makes Tabasco, let's talk a little bit about the product. This company and this family has come a long way on salt, vinegar, and some peppers, huh?
Well, absolutely. They've been around for 140 years, which is remarkable for a family business. And so they're now in 120 nations, and the profit margins are stupendous, 30, 40, 50%, depending on the year.
Let's go back to the history and in some ways, the mythology of the McElhaney family and this company in Tabasco sauce.
Yeah, well, the McElhaneys were on Avery Island up to the Civil War, and they had a sugar plantation there. And when the Civil War came, the Union threw the McElhaneys and the Averys off of the island. And when they came back at the end of the war, the island had been completely burnt down. So McElhaney was looking for a sort of a second act in his life and how to make money again, and he grew some peppers. Eventually, they produced Tabasco sauce out of it. But what McElhaney did then to that product to make it succeed so well is that he created a great brand around it and created myths around how that product came to be. One myth, for instance, was that he actually was the first to use the word Tabasco. Well, it's a state in Mexico, is Tabasco. So McElhaney used all of these kinds of myths around the product to get a trademark on the word Tabasco, which is incredible because there is no other company that has a trademark on the name of a place. You just can't get that.
They tried, didn't they, back in the 1990s to get a food professional in there to run the company? How did that go?
They hired this guy, Vince Pierce, who had been a professional food marketer for many, many years, because they realized that their growth was slowing. So Vince Pierce put all this money into promotion, and sales were actually picking up. But the family couldn't stomach all the money it cost to promote the product. They had just never done that before. And so after a year, they fired him.
Is the family just cheap?
Well, you know, part of the problem, and this is the one part of the business model that I think hurts them, every heir of Edmund McElhaney, who created the business, gets a piece of it at birth. Nobody wants to share that money with a promotional campaign. And so it's the growth of all of these heirs that have really shut down the ability of the company to spend their money in the way that they really need to do to continue to grow.
Before I let you go, what about you? How do you use it? Scrambled eggs, maybe?
Scrambled eggs are the best for them, I think. But I've learned to put them on pizza, and it really gives it that zest that pizza doesn't have.
The book by Jeffrey Rothfader is called McElhaney's Gold. It's about the family that started the Tabasco company. Mr. Rothfader, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
This next story is datelined Shanghai, China, last night. The NBA's Orlando Magic beat LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers 90-86. It was only a preseason game, so it doesn't count for too much. Except, you know, maybe for this. The NBA has now officially gone global. The league's wholly owned Chinese subsidiary, NBA China, opened for business on Monday. It's the league's biggest market outside the United States. And don't think sneaker companies and sports marketers haven't noticed. Marketplace's Scott Tong has more.
On the courts at Shanghai's Fudan University, the trash talk sounds a bit friendlier than in America. But otherwise, the scene's familiar. Young people emulating NBA stars. This 18-year-old just dropped 150 US for his purple Nikes.
Kobe.
I like Kobe. I just like Kobe Bryant. That's why I wear them. They're not the most comfortable. Some of my friends pay even more, like $225 for the Tracy McGrady shoes.
The NBA and its corporate sponsors are drooling over guys like this. The league's China revenues grew 50% last year, thanks mostly to licensing deals. This week, the NBA is going full bore to promote its China games. It flew in former San Antonio Spurs superstar George Gervin to run a basketball clinic underwritten by Adidas.
I shot the ball all the time.
You know?
And where I shot the ball, I think, makes a difference.
83% of Chinese men between 16 and 61 say they like hoops. They watch NBA games live on TV, and they recognize the stars, even the old-timers like Daryl Dawkins, a.k.a. Chocolate Thunder.
I've taken a picture with about 100 little old ladies, and I don't know if they knew me or I was just the biggest thing they've ever seen, but they seem to know me. They say, hey, that's Chocolate Thunder.
To cash in on basketball fever here, Spalding sponsored an NBA traveling exhibit across China, and Motorola ran a national two-on-two street tournament. But doing business in China is its own game. For instance, the youth tend not to, you know, just do it.
In China, traditionally, sport is something you watch.
Market researcher Sam Fleming.
Sport is not something you do for fun, necessarily. It's seen as a distraction.
From studying. So the challenge for, say, shoe companies is to promote exercise and to promote the notion of sports as entertainment. Right now, professional sports leagues exist not to sell tickets or merchandise. They're about breeding Olympic champions, says marketing veteran Tor Peterson.
The dismantling of a Eastern European sports model is a big step for China.
But it's hard to ignore the hundreds of millions of potential customers, like Edward Sheng. In college, he used to cut class to watch Yao Ming's Houston Rockets.
It is a Houston game, and I have a Marxist theory course. I drop it.
You skip class?
Yes.
Boring. That's beyond boring. Oh.
So much for Marxist theory. Bring on the capitalist profiteers from the sports world. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We can't leave China without mentioning another capitalist profiteer angle today. The country's chief of product safety said today orders for Chinese-made toys are actually up as the world shops for Christmas. He said factory workers are having to work overtime to meet the demand. Of course, he's also the government official put in charge of public relations after this summer's massive toy recalls.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, you may no longer be shocked by shady news about private defense contractors in Iraq, but corruption in war dealings is seeping into a new area, food supplies. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning that Sara Lee, ConAgra, and Purdue Farms have all received subpoenas from the Department of Defense. The companies are being questioned about fraud and corruption in supplying food to troops in Iraq, specifically whether they overcharged the Army's primary food contractor down in Kuwait. ConAgra and Sara Lee both said today they've been assured they're only witnesses in that investigation. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 20 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq added 28 points, that's 1%. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, that's a tenth of 1% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, shareholders betting against the house and making a profit.
If you have more disclosure, some hedge funds may be reluctant to do in the sunlight what they might be willing to do in the dark.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.